launched the Thinkers series. Hello and welcome to the EDTV Dialogues, a conversation of ideas. Today we launched the Thinkers series, and who better to join us than global thinker, Professor Kishore Mehboobani. Professor Mehboobani is currently a distinguished fellow at the National University of Singapore. He was also the founding dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, and of course has been an international diplomat, a prolific writer, and currently has just written his 10th book. This is an undiplomatic memoir about living the Asian century. Professor Mehboobani, thanks very much for being on the EDTV Dialogues.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let me begin by asking you an undiplomatic question. You just wrote a column in the FT, and for many India watchers and, of course, Indians here, it was very interesting because you proposed that the UK should actually give up its place on the UN Security Council for India. Why did you say that, and what was the reasoning behind that strongly worded article?
Well, I can tell you that this is not rocket science. This is just plain common sense. You know, I was ambassador to the UN twice, from 84 to 89 and 98 to 2004. And it's very clear that when the founders of the UN, you know, created the UN, they realized that the only way to make the United Nations work is to make sure that all the great powers of the day have a vested interest in the UN and not leave it. And that's why they gave the great powers veto powers and permanent membership of the UN Security Council. And I can say that the lesson that they learned from the collapse of the League of Nations early in the 20th century is that if a great power leaves, organization collapses. But they also believed that you must have the great powers of today, not the great powers of yesterday. Unfortunately, they didn't create a mechanism for changing the seats, but that was very clear that what they had in mind was to ensure that the great powers of the day were entrenched in the United Nations. And today is there's absolutely no question that India is the third most powerful country in the world after the United States and China. And Great Britain is no longer great, as we know. And frankly, the United Kingdom has effectively given up its veto in the UN Security Council because it hasn't used it for decades. They know that if they use it, people get very, very upset. So the logical thing to do is for the UK to give up its seat to India.
And of course, India has been saying this now, whether it's Prime Minister Modi, whether it's Foreign Minister Jayashankar, that really the UN and other multilateral organizations need to reform or, in a sense, perish. Now, interestingly, we've seen also that geopolitically, India has made a number of strategic moves over the last years. And of course, Prime Minister Modi being both in first Russia and then Ukraine, and India making it very clear that diplomatically and geopolitically, it's following the India way. How do you see these moves, and especially an interesting perspective from you, because it comes away from the West's planning that India often has to listen to in terms of analysis of its foreign policy?
Yeah, well, first a quick word on reform. I think Prime Minister Modi and Foreign Minister Dr. Jayashankar are absolutely right that the time has come to reform the United Nations. But, you know, as I said, having been ambassador there for over 10 years, they've been talking about Security Council reform since 1992 and nothing has happened. And that's why we need to make some dramatic moves, like persuading the United Kingdom to give up its seat to India. And that will be a step-by-step way of trying to improve, change the Security Council. But you're also right when you say that the India clearly is playing a bigger and bigger role in the world. I mean, look at the fact. Let me ask yourself a simple question. How many leaders in the world can comfortably visit both Russia and Ukraine and be received warmly by both countries? Very, very few countries in the world. And the fact that Prime Minister Modi can do that is a sign of how India has arrived as a major geopolitical actor. And therefore, the greatest scope that is given to India to play a role globally, like, for example, giving it a permanent membership in the UN Security Council, will enable India to do much more in terms of creating a better world.
Could this not happen with an expansion rather than giving up? Because we both know how idealistic it may sound, and especially in the UK. I mean, I doubt that any country would give up. You have, of course, made an argument on why they should, would actually give up that membership. Is there not an argument for expansion instead, or a recognition that you can't ignore the country which is the most currently the most populous in the world?
You know, countries cannot be great powers forever. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it would be better for British interests to give up its seat to India. Not only do you get the friendship of India, but it frees up the UK to act independently, because in the Security Council, essentially the UK has become a satellite state of the United States, and everyone knows it. And it's sad. It's sad to see a great country like the United Kingdom behave like a satellite state, incapable of disagreeing in any way with the United States.
No, and also, of course, there's the economic arguments. Of course, the perhaps a sense of history coming full circle, that a country which once colonized India is now, of course, India emerging as an economic power, the third largest economy. But there also remains the fact that India has challenges on its path of becoming from an emerging economy to actually becoming a developed economy. That's something which is on the political agenda for now, but challenges remain. And many say, let's look at other ways of judging it, because otherwise, how can you say it just judge India on GDP and not look at per capita income? Your views on that?
Well, I would say at the end of the day, what matters is the size of your GDP, not your per capita income. Let me give you one statistic that illustrates this. Mm-hmm. In the year 1980, the combined GDP of the European Union countries was 8 times bigger than China. 8 times bigger, 1980. Today, they are about the same size. By 2050, the European Union will be half the size of Europe. Can you imagine Europe going from being 8 times bigger than China to becoming half the size of China? Now, of course, China's GDP will continue to remain lower than that of Europe. But functionally, China is now a much larger, more powerful actor than all of Europe. And this is part of a dramatic global shift away from the West to the rest. Now, many countries in the West may have lower per capita GDPs, but what matters at the end of the day is the size of your economy, because that will determine your place in the global hierarchy. And certainly in PPP terms now, number one is China, number two is United States, number three is India. Mm-hmm. And that's why these are the three most powerful countries in the world today.
You've made that point in your essays, etc., that this whole, in a sense, the West having lost control of the world, the crisis of leadership in the West, and how the global South and the whole shift of power is really what's going to define geopolitics, not just now, but in the decades and century to come. You, of course, have written extensively on the Asian century. Many observers have said that this could be the Indian century. Tell us why you think the West is in a crisis of, say, leadership, geopolitical strategy, and why you think there's been this shift of balance of power.
Well, the West clearly has got to accept that its capacity to dominate the world in the way that it could in the past is over. I mean, it's hard to believe this, right, Sonia? 100 years ago, in the year 1924, 100,000 Englishmen could rule over 300 million of our ancestors, the Indians. And I find that quite amazing. 100,000 Englishmen ruling 300 million Indians? How is that possible? But it happened. It was real. The West was just so incredibly powerful. But the world has come full circle now. And the West now represents 12% of the world's population. The rest make up 88%. And as I already illustrated by comparing Europe's GNP with China's GNP, the relative share of the GNP of the Western countries is going down. Let me give you another comparison. Mm-hmm. Okay. In the year 2000, roughly around then, the combined GNP of the G7 countries representing the West was 2.5 times bigger than the BRICS countries in PPP terms. Now G7 is smaller than BRICS. See? That's how times have changed. And absolutely. So the intelligent thing for the West to do is to adapt intelligently and thoughtfully. And I must emphasize, I don't speak here as an enemy of the West. I speak here as a friend of the West, trying to persuade both the Europe and United States that it would be wiser for them to share power, to share control of international institutions with the countries of the Global South. And, you know, for example, why do we have this absurd rule that says that to become the head of the IMF, you must be a European. To become the head of the World Bank, you must be an American citizen. Why not allow Asians to run these institutions? Because the fastest growing economies in the world are not European, not American, but Asian economies. So these are examples of how we must adapt mm-hmm. to the 21st century. And the 21st century, I want to emphasize, will be the Asian century. Because it will be the rise of not just China and India, but other Asian powers too. One small point I'd like to make here is that Indians should pay special attention to Southeast Asia, to the 10 ASEAN countries. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, 9 out of the 10 Southeast Asian countries have an Indic base in their culture. For 2,000 years, India has been very close to Southeast Asia. And Southeast Asia is emerging as a major growth pole in the world also. And I'll just give you one more statistic
sure.
that I think every Indian should be aware of. You know, in the year 2000, out of the 3.5 billion people who live in the three growth poles, the CIA, China, India, ASEAN. CIA doesn't mean Central Intelligence Agency. It means China, India, ASEAN. Out of the 3.5 billion people living in the CIA countries, only 150 million people enjoyed middle-class living standards. Today, out of 3.5 billion, by 2020, the number hit 1.5 billion. It went up 10 times in 20 years. By 2030, it will be 2.5 to 3 billion.
The numbers are, the scale is actually staggering. And what I want to ask, because you made that point also about Western ideas and thoughts, which tend to have dominated the worldview because of their earlier dominance. And this whole issue of democracy, liberal democracies, etc. India, in that sense, is an outlier of democracy, given our region of South Asia, where we, of course, face from Pakistan, India, Pakistan are completely dehyphenated. But you've got Pakistan on one border, you've got China on another border, you've got Bangladesh, and we've seen the collapse that suddenly happened there. Where do you see India geopolitically in a very difficult region? And also in a region where they are currently a democratic outlier. We saw also what's happened in Sri Lanka 2 years ago. So the whole South Asian model of democracy and the Asian model of democracy has been very, very different from what we've seen in the West. And clearly there's no one size that fits all.
You're absolutely right. There's no one size fits all. And it's true that many developing countries are struggling with democracy, but there are also, importantly, some success stories that we should pay attention to. India is, of course, a very good success story. In democracy, you have regular elections and the winning parties accept the results of the mm-hmm. elections. As you know, what shocked the world was in the year 2020 when Donald Trump refused to accept the results yes. of the elections. That's supposed to happen, you know, in the third world developing countries, but it happened in the United States of America. But I also want to point out that apart from India, Indonesia mm-hmm. Is also another very successful democracy. It is, you know, the most populous Islamic country in the world. It has had very peaceful elections. It has had very peaceful changes of leaders, from President SBY to President Jokowi, soon to President Prabowo. And so there are other success stories in the developing world too. And I think in the case of India, I think it's important for India to continue to succeed and serve as a source of inspiration for Asia and for the rest of the world.
I mentioned briefly the crisis of Western leadership that you've talked about. And we've seen in a time when the world seems to be in global conflict, what's currently happening in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia, what's currently happening in Gaza. And you said this is actually a failure in a sense of geopolitics. Tell me more about what you meant about that. And let's just look also at what's currently happening between India and China.
Well, I've been studying geopolitics now for, I guess, 53 years, since 1971. And I think we should have a simple rule that says that wars reflect geopolitical incompetence. Peace reflects geopolitical competence. And certainly, I think what Europeans need to ask themselves is a simple question. Is it, why is it they set up so many institutions like OSCE and they fail to stop the war in Ukraine? And, you know, of course, there's no question that the Russian invasion of Ukraine is illegal, which is why the UN correctly condemned it. But that war could have been avoided if the countries of Europe had listened to very eminent statesmen like Henry Kissinger, like George Kennan, who advised Europe against pushing Ukraine to NATO because you were crossing a red line of Russia unnecessarily. That was not necessary at all. And similarly, unfortunately, the war in Gaza sadly reflects, and certainly we should condemn the attack by Hamas on innocent Israeli civilians, but that conflict could also have been avoided if the United States had used its diplomatic muscles to try and push for a two-state solution effectively between Israel and Palestine. And you see, very sadly, you see that the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, has gone to the Middle East, I don't know how many times, and has been completely unable to achieve either a ceasefire or some kind of pause in the fighting. And it's very sad, because that incapability to stop wars and prevent wars also reflects geopolitical incompetence. By contrast, by the way, most of East Asia, you haven't seen a major war since 1979, since the Sino-Vietnamese War. But of course, there are challenges in our region. And you correctly pointed out one big challenge, and that challenge is the relationship between China and India. And there's one thing that worries me when I talk about the Asian century. You know, I believe that the Asian century is going to happen. And certainly I expect, as I gave you the data, China, India, ASEAN, and frankly, you've got to add Japan, South Korea, and others are going to flourish and do well. But if relations between China and India become difficult, and if they get caught in any kind of downward spiral, that would sadly affect the rest of Asia too.
So in that sense, India has some very complex challenges, because one, you have, of course, the concern about Russia and China becoming closer, perhaps as a fallout also of Russia's isolation from the West. You have the worry over Pakistan becoming a failed state and what that does to more fundamentalist elements. And of course, the continuing, in that sense, aggression or incursions backed by Pakistan forces in Jammu and Kashmir. You have also the worry of Afghanistan and the Taliban, and now what's happening in Bangladesh. How do you think India, what do you think are the best ways ahead for India to actually maneuver this complex tightrope walk, as it were, in its region?
Well, I think let's start with the first example you gave of Russia. As you know, Russia has been a very good friend to India. I mean, I know that whenever India had some problems in the UN Security Council, and when they wanted to block countries from taking measures that would be hostile to India, India could always turn to the Russian delegation. And the Russian delegation would always say to the Indian delegation, if you want us to veto a resolution, we'll be happy to do so on your behalf. Mm-hmm. So I can understand the deep friendship that has developed between Russia and India. But I think if India wants to help Russia in its current predicament, the best thing that India could do is to repeat what George Kennan, the eminent American strategic thinker, what Henry Kissinger said, which is that to try and arrive at a compromise on Ukraine, whereby the people of Ukraine have their sovereign right to do what they want to do, to be what they want to be. And frankly, they want to join the European Union, they can join the European Union, but they shouldn't join NATO. You know, that's a compromise. So it takes care of the core interests of all the powers. And most people know that that's a sensible solution to push for. And at the end of the day, I think it's important for India, which is now big enough, to speak privately to the European Union members and tell them that at the end of the day, Europe will have to live with Russia, not for the next 10 years, not for the next 100 years, but for the next 1,000 years. Why create a very angry, alienated Russia? Why not try to build bridges with Russia? And if you can normalize the relations, if India can help to normalize relations between Russia and Europe and help to find a solution to Ukraine, then India will once again have a very strong friend in Russia that it can work with without a problem. So I think there are various things that India can do. And, you know, in terms of its neighborhood, I would say the one good thing that India could do is to learn something from ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. You know, the diversity in Southeast Asia is much more than the diversity in South Asia. You know, you have out of 700 million people in Southeast Asia, you have 250 million Muslims, 150 million Christians, 150 million Buddhists, Mahayana Buddhists, Hinayana Buddhists. And then we have Taoists, we have Confucianists, we have Hindus, and we have lots of communists in Southeast Asia. And yet Southeast Asia has been at peace. ASEAN is a model of regional cooperation. And the way we have done it, one way we have done it, is to open our borders completely to trade with each other. And that growing trade with each other has generated context and understanding. And that's why I believe that provides a model for South Asia to follow also.
You've talked, of course, about the United States and in that sense, Secretary of State Antony Blinken's failures or the US's failures in to control the Gaza war. But also, let me ask you, as we've got the November presidential elections coming up between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. Do you think that, in a sense, what is good for the world? Because do you think a second term for President Trump is something that would be good globally, geopolitics-wise? Do you think President Kamala Harris, if it happens? And also, of course, when you've talked about great statesmen, great leadership, who do you think are, say, the top five leaders of today? Where do you think the real leadership is coming from globally?
Well, I'm glad you raised the question about the United States, because there's no question whatsoever that the United States is by far still the most powerful country in the world in a comprehensive sense. And I always say that I'm a friend of the United States, and certainly we in Singapore want to see a strong, capable United States. And the United States is playing an important leadership role on the world stage. But as you know, the United States can only play an important leadership role on the world stage if it is domestically a happy country. But as you know, the United States today has never been unhappier. In fact, if you look at my book, Has China Won, in Chapter 7, I point out that sadly, functionally, the United States has become a plutocracy where the rich make the decisions. And as a result of it, the bottom 50% in the United States have not seen an improvement in their standard of living for 3 or 4 decades now. And that's very sad. We want to see a better United States than this one. But all these internal problems of the United States are now preoccupying the American people and also the American leaders. And so whether Donald Trump wins or Kamala Harris wins, they will have to focus their attention primarily on their domestic needs, which are growing significantly. And as you know, Donald Trump's the words he uses, make America great again.
Yes.
So he wants to take care of his home first, which is in some ways is understandable. But it means that the previous United States that we knew, that was willing to provide in some ways selfless global leadership, is no longer around. It's just going to be an America that puts American interests first, regardless whether it's Kamala Harris or Donald Trump.
Right.
So we shouldn't focus on the personalities, but we should nonetheless try to continue working as closely as possible with the United States, because at the end of the day, if United States is not part of the solution, it's going to become part of the problem. United States is an indispensable power still in the world.
Professor Mehboobani, thank you so much for outlining your views on the Asian century and, of course, India's role in it in the decades and century to come. Thank you very much for joining me on the NDTV Dialogues. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.